is that Czech?
It's Croatian, actually.
Croatian, really? Yeah. I should know that. I was the attaché in New Smyrna.
Oh, well, yes.
Ellen's with the Multnomah County DA's office and will be filling in and helping us as we go through our bills. She's also helping Representative Brad Witt's House Committee on Workforce and Economic Development. Committee members today will be holding public hearing only on two bills and will take them in order. So first, I'll open the public hearing on 2379. Council, will you brief us on the bill, please?
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. House Bill 2379 allows the district attorney to treat the felony of unlawful possession of heroin or unlawful possession of ecstasy as a Class A misdemeanor. Until last session, as I think most of you know, Oregon separated the different controlled substances. I mean, they passed a bill to separate the controlled substances, and when that happened, there was an unintended consequence that the authority that the district attorney already possessed to reduce certain felonies to misdemeanors, and that included heroin and ecstasy, appears to have been left out of the bill, and so this bill fixes that unintended consequence.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, committee members, on the briefing of the bill? I was hoping you were going to pronounce the. I've been practicing. I couldn't do it.
Yes, I too skipped the
I think that's methyl. I think that's why Representative Barker said he'd let me chair today. No one wants to pronounce the bill, the drug. Okay, I don't see. Oh, Craig came out. Okay, Mr. Prince, you want to step up and our first testimony this morning?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Prince. Sorry, I stepped out, so I wanted to. I don't know if Ellen gave you the statutes, but I wanted to walk you through what House Bill 2379 does. Last session with the meth package, we took the drug before 2005, all of the possession, delivery, and manufacture drug crimes were all in one statute. And make sure I know which. That statute is now 475.840. So if you look at your bill on line 8, ORS 475.8403A is basically the section in the catch-all that has all the drug crimes that says, and Ellen, I've got these if you want to, I'm collating as we go. That is the section of the law that allows for Schedule 1 drug offenses, Schedule 1 possession drug offenses, that's where they're charged. So ORS 475.8403A is where a prosecutor would charge someone with possessing a Schedule 1 drug. And the two drugs that we're talking about here are, I'm not going to try to pronounce it. It's ecstasy. Did anyone try to pronounce that?
You missed my comment.
I never could pronounce it. But ecstasy is a Schedule 1 drug, and heroin is a Schedule 1 drug. That refers to how the feds put that on a food and drug schedule. So under current law and under the law before we had the meth package, that's how you would charge a guy with possessing heroin or ecstasy. When we broke out all the drug crimes last session, we didn't put heroin and ecstasy, which are those two ORSs. 475.854 is unlawfully possessing heroin. ORS 475.874 is unlawfully possessing ecstasy. So what this bill does is avoids the problem of where, let me back up. We've encouraged the police and the DAs to use the new crime numbers so that we can track what type of crime it is. Is it, so we know what drug it is and what illegal activity it is. Is it possession, delivery, or manufacture? And so when we did that, we wanted to make it clear that it doesn't matter if the officer cites the guy under the old catch-all, which would be 475.8403A, or under the new statute that shows that it's possession of heroin and possession of ecstasy, either way, they can still do this here in ORS 161.570. And Ellen could tell you what this is it allows the DAs to reduce those down to a Class A misdemeanor if they, in their discretion. So to make a long story short, what this does is a technical fix. It doesn't matter if the charge is under 840 or the new charges, they can still do the same thing. And what it fixes is it allows us to use the new breakout crimes, so there's not a confusion in this statute. And I've got all the statutes I just mentioned, and I'm going to, while if there's any, I can collate them into a package for you, and if you want me to, I know I just spouted a lot of ORS numbers at you, but I can walk you through it if there's any questions.
Committee members, any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
What would be some of the circumstances that you might see where a DA would want to take that felony down? What would be some of the mitigating circumstances they would be looking at? I don't want it to appear that we're making it easy to possess these
sure.
drugs when maybe people, the public might think that these should be felonies.
I can answer that, or Ellen can answer that, whichever you prefer. Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I was a district attorney in Multnomah County for about 4 years. And in some of the larger counties, there's so many people who are charged with felony possession that there are cases where on a first offense they'll reduce it down to a misdemeanor. It's basically dealing with the volume of street-level drug possession. Sometimes the prosecutors currently will reduce it. You avoid having to go to grand jury that way. You avoid some substantial costs for witnesses. You avoid, as you know, officer overtime on a grand jury, where in reality, there's really not going to be a big difference in most people's mind as to if they get convicted of a misdemeanor or felony on one of these small drug offenses, kind of what supervision there's going to be. So that's the, and I couldn't tell you which counties right now are doing that, but definitely the counties, for example, that are being hit with losing ONC funds, they're going to be trying to figure out how do we prioritize where we, who we prosecute for a felony and who we prosecute for a misdemeanor to try to avoid as many costs as they can. So it's basically just dealing with that issue.
Good. Any other questions, committee members? Thank you, Mr. Prince.
Thank you.
Next witness to testify is Ann Christian.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ann Christian. I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Just briefly, we support House Bill 2379, not only because it clears up some confusion that has happened over the last interim, but based upon one of our basic premises, which is we believe that district attorneys and judges ought to have the greatest latitude possible to deal with the individuals who are before the court, especially on drug crimes. So, for example, a first-time offender might be offered misdemeanor treatment if they have gone through treatment or done something positive. And so we see this latitude that is restored in House Bill 2379 as a positive thing as far as cost-saving, as Mr. Prince indicated, but also for the individual who's before the court. And so we support it, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Committee members? No questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thanks, Ann. Just to be clear, so this, prior to last session, this was able to be done, and because of what Mr. Krim said in the meth package, it just got swept up, and so we're just trying to correct that. Is that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, that is my understanding,
okay.
That we aren't creating any new opportunity, but there has been some confusion over the interim.
Thank you.
Could you comment on Representative Krieger's concern? I think that's been voiced to me that this is being perceived as we're lowering the crime for these crimes.
Mr. Chair, I would say you're not lowering it. You're correcting an error, frankly, from the 2005 session. And a former legislature made the policy decision, and I'm uncertain when, probably in the 80s, that for, and this really is generally, I practice in Multnomah, so I should limit it to Multnomah. This is something that is used for first offenders, someone who's compelling with respect to why they should be offered this misdemeanor treatment. It's important for an individual who is employed or is seeking employment, who doesn't want to be in the position of having to check that box on the job application that they've been convicted of a felony, possession of a drug. So I would answer your question by saying I don't believe you're making any policy change from the policy that was adopted by the legislature when they originally allowed these two offenses to, in the discretion of the DA, get misdemeanor treatment. And, of course, the district attorneys are politically, I mean, they're elected, and so I can't imagine that there are many out there who are willy-nilly offering misdemeanor treatment to someone who's not totally deserving.
Thank you for those comments. Okay. We have also now Mr. Luca and Mr. Rogers. You want to come up together, please? We're going to identify yourself. Mark, you're going to do it first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Luca. I do work for members in this building, but my testimony today is my own as a private citizen. I came here to support and to introduce to you John Rogers, who is an employee of mine at a business I own outside my scope of employment here. I've known John. He's been in my employ nearly 6 months. He's a recovering meth addict, and he asked to come and speak to you today on this issue. And I would just say that I've over the last 6 months, I've gained a lot of respect for John as I've seen him deal with his prior addiction and get his life back in order. And I've been excited and I'd say proud to be part of that process with him. So I'd ask you to be attentive to him. John.
Give us your name first, sir.
My name is John Rogers. Mr. Chairman and committee. I oppose this bill, not because I distrust the district attorney or anybody like that. I'm a recovering addict. I know what this drug does to people. I've spent countless amounts of money, lost a business, almost lost my family. I've got a nephew that's in another state just recently because of an overdose of ecstasy and methamphetamines. I got a godson that's in prison right now. If you guys, it's kind of, I got to calm down. This is really kind of, I've never done this before and I'm
doing
really,
fine.
Really nervous.
You're doing fine.
When I started using this drug, it was like $20 a day. Then next thing I know, I was up to $150 a day. I lost my, like I said, I lost my business. I almost lost my family. Beforehand, me and my family would go camping and fishing and all this stuff. Doing this drug and getting caught doing this drug, being caught was a good thing. And the charges that I faced from it made me wake up. I stayed clean for probably 2 months, first time I got on probation. Then I got in a big old fight with my wife, and I did some, got in trouble, ended up spending 14 days in jail. My PO told me if I did it again, I was going to prison for 5 years. I didn't want that to happen. I've got a lot of respect for all you guys here that make these bills pass and whatnot, but I don't see that making it a misdemeanor as a first offense or anything like that is going to help anybody. All I've seen is anybody that's ever done this drug goes back to this drug. unless they're they pay for the crime that they do and get through their treatment and make sure things are right. Like I said, really nervous.
Now that you've done well. When
I really do oppose the way this bill's set up, because it just doesn't seem right that with heroin and methamphetamines, all these drugs that are Schedule I offenses, they should just stay felonies and not be turned over as misdemeanors for people to choose who and what gets to have a misdemeanor or whatnot. If you're going to do this stuff, then you need to pay for it. I'm recovering. I'm doing everything. I've been tempted. No, I haven't done it. I'm looking, you know, I got a life now with my family, friends, whatnot. If I do this drug, I lose it all. I lose my employment. I lose my family. All the trust that I've gained in the last 2 years. Everything. And I don't want that. And people should be able to wake up from this, the use of this. I know it's a growing major crime. And people steal for it. They beat people. They even commit murder for it. This drug. It should not be a misdemeanor. It should stay a felony. I would like to push for it to go from a Schedule II to a Schedule I felony. That's how bad these are.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Thank you very much for that personal testimony. Committee members, Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. I just really appreciate your courage to be here, and you did a great job with your testimony. I just want to clarify the way I interpret this bill. It doesn't change the possession from, it doesn't change the class of this drug. It just allows the district attorney their option to reduce it to a misdemeanor. And I want to use your, in your case, as an example of, it sounds like that was applied to you.
No. It was not applied to me as a misdemeanor.
Oh, okay.
It was applied as a felony.
Okay. But what this bill does do is allow the district attorney and the courts to take a look at a situation. It doesn't reduce the penalty that may be enforced, if I'm correct. It just allows a flexibility for the courts to be able to prosecute cases at a different level if they so desire to do that, based on the individual situation and their situation. Is that accurate?
For my
correct, Representative Cameron.
Can I repeat that for you? Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, when John spoke with me about this earlier today, he said that that it's such a scourge that really it needs to be a felony in all cases, especially the first time, because that's the time that has the most impact on the addict. So his position was that he wanted to see it remain a felony in all cases, not discounting the ability of district attorneys to make qualified decisions. He's just saying from the addict's point of view that the stick was more powerful than the carrot.
Okay, well, thank you, Mark and Mr. Rogers, very much for your testimony. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else to testify on this bill this morning? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2379. And we'll open the public hearing on 2511. Council, please give us a description.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2511 expands the crime of criminal mischief in the second degree to include intentionally tampering or interfering with devices that are intended to restrict access to roads that are closed to the public. Currently, criminal mischief in the second degree occurs when a person commits criminal mischief in the third degree, satisfies all of those elements, and then certain other aggravating factors, namely that damage occurs. That's the current crime of criminal mischief in the second degree, and this bill would expand criminal mischief in the second degree to include conduct where a person, and this is the exact language, having no right to do so nor reasonable ground to believe that the person has such right, the person intentionally tampers or interferes with a sign, gate, or other device that is intended to restrict public access to a road or market as currently closed to public use.
Thank you. Committee, have any questions first on the description of the bill?
One question, Mr. Chair, is that's public access. Does it designate private property from public property?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, the bill as it is currently written does not make that distinction.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, our first witness, Representative Lim, do you want to come up to testify, please? Good morning, John.
Good morning. Good morning again, Chair Wiesenhut and members of the committee. And for the record, my name is John Lim, state representative from District 50. And I'm sure you all know and heard about the James Gimes tragedy which happened around the time of last year, December Thanksgiving. And he lost his life searching for help, while his wife and two children were able to save. And also in December, early part, three young men lost in the mountain, Mount Hood. And then one person found dead, two person still missing, presumed to be dead. And I know personally James Gimes' father, whose name is Spencer Gim. I have known him more than 10 years. We've been a good friends. And so when tragedy happens, not only is a great loss to their family, but friends like me also affected me a lot. And also the young person his name was James Cook also, right?
Jerry
Cook, who lost in the Mount Hood in the early December last year. I also know his mother, who is in the Brooklyn, New York area. And then she came here, and I met her, and she went back because she couldn't wait any longer. So December and November, that the both time tragedy happened, and happened to be, I have known them, both of them. Out of that concern, I have introduced the House Bill 2511, which already the Ellen explained what it does. And the legislation comes as a result of James Gimes' tragedy in November 2006. Gimes' family, a personal friends of mine, they contacted me and asked how I can help prevent a tragedy like the one their family endured. We believe this tragedy has taught us many lessons and hope that through this legislation, increasing the criminal penalties associated with the sign tampering and future tragedy may be averted. It is possible that this tragedy may have been averted if the gate that allowed access to the logging road had been properly blocked and the signs for the road clearly marked. We want clear signs warning against access to the road with treacherous terrain. We also want the signs and the roadblocks to be regularly monitored, especially in the winter months. This tragedy happen in the future, it's bound to happen again. Tragedy happened in the past, the hope that this tragedy bound to happen sometime in the future if we don't act properly. I'm introducing for your information the centralized command system when two or more counties involved in such accident happens. Because last time when James Gim's family was lost, 10 different group of agencies tried to do their own things without the centralized command system. And life depends on the coordination, and life depends on the timing and of this how to handle. If we were able to find them earlier, we were able to save James Gim's life. Because out of that concern, I introduce also another bill that when two or three counties involves, then there should be a centralized command system to be created. And also one is a sign tampering issue today, and also the another one when someone goes into the Mount Hood area, that if they climb more than 10,000 feet, then they need to carry locator beacons. Of course, this is not issue at this moment, but I hope that with your support, we can do something about this issue, passing bill, House Bill 2511.
Thank you, Representative Lim. Thanks for taking on this call on behalf of your friends. Committee members? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lim, for being here. I remember how tragic this story was. There was a lot of press, I remember, during this time, and a lot of different stories on television and in the newspaper. And I seem to recall at one point hearing that one of the gates was left open because the people in charge of the gates thought maybe there was somebody back there, and they were afraid they were going to shut them in rather than leave them access to get out. Do you recall that? Is that something that...
Yes, of course I read and I recall what I'm hearing through the newspapers, and then the gate has been never shut, shut closed. Maybe from the Bureau of Land Management they might be able to explain further, but to my understanding the gate was not properly closed. I'm not sure whether it's closed or someone else opened it, but the information I have, the gate have never been closed in the November time.
Committee members, we will be hearing from the Department of State Lands and the Oregon Forest Industries later.
Follow up?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This isn't a question, it's a comment. I just wanted to let you know I'm aware of your other bill about the climbing devices, and I went to speak to a very large group of Boy Scouts in my district last week, and I gave that to them to keep track of.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative
Mr. Chair, I haven't been able to talk to you, Representative, but that particular area is the area that I was assigned for 28 years in the state police, and I know it like the back of my hand. Those roads, for the most part, dead end most of the spur roads off of all logging roads, as it does in all of Oregon, and normally they're open to the public for hunting and mining and camping and trail riding and those types of things. But when it becomes inclement winter weather, maybe in November through till the snow comes off, you know, they maybe should be gated. One of the things you deal with is people that do, you know, have vandalism on locks and shoot signs and this type of thing. But a bigger problem in my mind is that these are forest lands that originally for multiple use produced timber dollars, and that was used for the maintenance of the roads themselves, for the safety of the road, signage and that type of thing. Now that we've set everything aside and wait to the next fire to burn it, there is no dollars coming off of those lands to pay for all these types of things. So the federal agencies, if you take the area up where we're talking about, down to Agnes, and what was harvested in there from the 60s till I retired in 91, you could pave it with silver dollars 6 feet deep and have money in the bank. But unfortunately, all that money went to D.C. and was used for every purpose that you can think of other than forestry and forest management or preservation of the forest and forest research, you name it. It was used for everything else. Now they say they don't have any money. Well, of course you don't have any money. You've misspent it. You've done exactly the opposite with what I would be required to do as a private forest landowner to be in compliance with the forest practice rules. The road, the Forest Service roads, do not meet in many, many places the standards that I'm required by law to maintain the roads and the culverts for water flow and those types of things, so we don't have debris build up. But that is the condition not only there, but it's all over the western United States where you have these large amounts of federal land. And that's the DeKing road system. Well, they want to put them to bed. So they spend millions and millions of dollars of putting these roads to bed when you could, in fact, do very light maintenance on them, have culverts looked at, and I don't think it would cost you near as much, and you'd maintain public access, and you could, do what you say, gate some of these roads and prevent some of these things from happening. What took place with Mr. Kim was tragic. But those of us who live out in the rural area, like I do, have been there all my life, every mistake that you could make to let this happen, he made. And it's a shame. He was in an environment that he was not familiar with. That sometimes happens. It's just like if myself was to go up and start climbing Mount Hood at 66 years old, I'm sure I'd get in trouble in a hurry. But every mistake that was made, that he made, I would have not made simply because I understood the environment that I was in and what I was dealing with. So that's another separate issue we need to understand. And it was a tragedy. We all watched it unfold, and I saw some of that road. And I can remember, I've been there. I've done that. I've been there. I understand what that is. Here again, I was in search and rescue in Curry County for several years before I came here. And people do strange things out there. Mushroom pickers do things you wouldn't believe. Well, we have to go find them. Sitting in the middle of a creek 50 yards from a road. It totally shouldn't have been there. But getting back to the issue of what you're doing, I think proper signage, closing some of these spur roads, especially in the areas of high altitude where there's snow, is very doable. And the problem we deal, we can do this, but this is federal land. We can't mandate any of this on federal land. So this is maybe good for us, maybe on private land, where there'd be some liability for a timber company. But I'm not certain we can mandate this on the federal government, Forest Service, BLM roads. Maybe they, it would be an indicator to them that we think this is very serious and they need to address it. But the maintenance dollars aren't there because they're not managing the forest.
Thank you, Representative. Anything else, Representative Lim?
Well, Mr. Chair, Wisner and members, I do appreciate your attention, especially the comment made by the Representative Krieger. And he knows that area well than anyone else. And then at some end, unanswered questions might be able to clear up by the Department of Land Use or the BLM or any other agencies. Yes. So if they are here, maybe they might be able to clarify some of the issues, which I'm not quite familiar with.
Did your assistant want to testify to?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Seth Hatmaker, Chief of Staff for Representative Lim. I do think one thing should be kind of elaborated on. The current status of interfering with signs and tampering can be classified at the officer's discretion as a violation, which in many times is kind of a slap on the wrist. And when we're talking about inclement weather, that's just not cutting it. I mean, I don't know if there's enough deterrence there to get a slap on the wrist. And then some of the discussions I had with State Lands, Forestry, and BLM was that sometimes signs don't last a week. People go out and they shoot them. And I think, that just kind of needed to be elaborated on. But, thank you for the invitation.
Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
The next person that signed up is Mr. Purchase, Department of State Lands. I'll declare a conflict of interest to begin with. Steve lives in my district.
It's a conflict. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Steve Purchase, Assistant Director for the Department of State Lands. I have given you some written testimony, but I'd like to summarize the testimony and elaborate on a couple of things that I think that are pertinent to this this particular bill. Our department manages 2.3 million acres of land, and that's both waterways, surface lands, and subsurface lands. For the purpose of the Common School Fund and also for the public use and enjoyment. And those lands are typically open for a multitude of activities, as Representative Krueger brought up, hunting, fishing, camping, recreational pursuits. We also lease those lands for, for forage, for grazing cattle, for timber harvest, for any number of business uses that we use our lands for. Occasionally, we have to close those lands to public use to protect either ecological or historical, or protect the land from trespass and vandalism. And we do that by going through some public rulemaking to make the public aware that we're about to close those lands. And when we close those lands, we typically go out and sign those lands, or we have to put up a gate. Gates are our last options, to be quite frank. We try to sign it as best we can, either to let the public know what the restriction is or to guide them away from maybe a sensitive ecological area. When we do that, it's been our experience that the signs don't always last. Usually they're gone within a very short period of time. I'll give an example. About 2 months ago, I went up and put this sign up myself up on the Columbia River because we have a conflict with a number of private landowners and some ATV users. I didn't get back to Salem before these four signs were taken down and destroyed. And the landowner called me as soon as I got back, thanked me for coming up and putting the signs in, but said they're already taken down. You know, ATVers came in and broke the signs, broke the 4x4 posts that we just placed. So it is a problem for us when we do that. A lot of the lands that we manage, particularly those submersible and submerged lands or statutory lands that are more open for the public that aren't necessarily leased out. So we work with local groups, Boy Scout groups, or Friends of Dibley Point, or some group to help us sign and manage those lands, and they put their private dollars into those signs as well. And, you know, they report the same thing to me, that the signs simply do not last, they don't stay up very long, and there's considerable damage and cost to replace these signs. We don't track the dollars per se for every sign or action that we take. What we do is, if we have a project that we're fortunate enough to save a few dollars on, we'll take that money and buy signs. Over the years, and just a couple of kind of general signs about what we are using these days because it's cost effective. These are about $7 a piece. This particular one's closed to ATV use and motorized use. This one says closed overnight fires and overnight camping. We've had to do that because of damage to the lands. And we try to do that because these are $7 a piece and they're fairly inexpensive. But if you look at our land base is somewhat scattered. And to send a staff person out to an area we call Swampy Creek in eastern Oregon, it takes 3 hours, 3.5 hours to get there to put the sign up. And if it doesn't last very long, then we've expended a great amount of resources to be able to do that. We believe it's important to sign the lands to let people know, particularly the public, if there is a restriction on the land or if there is a danger or a hazard on the land. We had experience a couple years ago where a culvert washed out during a flood, and it was a very popular road for hunters to go back to hunting areas. There was a washout there, so we put a sign up to notify folks that road was impassable. Sign didn't made it about a week. Well, we went back and replaced it. It was a 4x4 sign we had made by ODOT Sign Shop, cost $350. It was shot to pieces in less than a week. So our department supports the bill and the intent of the bill. We would like to be able to help correct the public and prevent the tragedies that happened with Mr. Kim and his family. It was indeed a tragedy, and we support the bill. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, committee members. Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, I had an opportunity to do a little ride-along with Polk County, and I guess it was the State Forest Department and the cooperation they're working with Polk County sheriffs on dumping issues and catching people with these micro cameras. Have you partnered up or in some of these locations where you're getting a lot of vandalism on your signs, tried to work with law enforcement to catch any of these people? Or maybe, and maybe you can clarify on the dumping of dumping crimes versus shooting up a sign. Maybe we've got two different levels of prosecution here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, yes, we have. I'll give you two real-life examples. Down on the lower Sandy River, we have an area there that is used as a homeless camp. We have worked in cooperation with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Department, the U.S. Forest Service law enforcement officers, ourselves, in trying to first sign, let people know that the area is closed. That was one of these that says closed overnight camping. But also to put up some surveillance cameras so we could try to determine who was using the land or damaging the signs. Now, that also the cost for us. We were fortunate that the county picked up that cost. So we have done that. We've also worked, particularly in rural Oregon, with the local sheriff department or the BLM law enforcement officers or the wilderness rangers, who we have a lot of land that's interspersed with their lands, in trying to determine or catch folks who would be vandalizing our property. Surveillance cameras in eastern Oregon are a little tougher to do because there's not a lot of power out there to be able to run the cameras. So we haven't gotten very far on that one. We've also done some outreach with Oregon hunters to make sure that they know that we have a couple of very sensitive areas in eastern Oregon that we're concerned about damage to historical cabins. We had a group going there last year that actually cut down part of a historical cabin for firewood. We asked them not to do that. Of course, we don't know who did it. We did have OSP investigate that to the best of their knowledge. We've not been able to determine who did that. But we do work with law enforcement to try to catch them.
Okay, follow up?
Follow up, if I may. The camera equipment that I saw ran on batteries. It was pretty self-sufficient and could be in remote areas and hidden. And I guess it leads me up to a question. We're not in ways and means here, but when you say those signs cost $7, I'm curious as to the vendor and you know, if we could save I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of those signs, but if you could save a dollar on a sign, maybe we could invest in some camera equipment. But the other thing, I guess my question was, is do you know the difference in prosecution for somebody for dumping versus somebody for shooting up a sign or vandalism on a building? And that's what I'm trying to get at with this bill, is we're raising the level of where we can prosecute somebody for vandalizing a sign or a gate. And I'm curious as to the level of dumping. You know where those stand? Because I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I'm not familiar enough with the statutes to be able to answer your question about what the legal ramifications of dumping versus shooting up a sign are. I would add that we get our signs put together by ODOT Sign Shop. We found that to be the most cost-effective.
That's why they're $7. Right. Okay.
And so we try to get those signs put together. But more specifically, more toward illegal dumping. Not only homeless camps do we have illegal dumping and trash to deal with, but we own a piece of property right outside Bend we all call Section 11. It's right on intersection of a couple main throughways, but what we're finding more and more is it's become a dump ground for people who don't want to pay dump fees.
Right.
And we're gonna spend about $6,000 this coming biennium just to clean that 640 acres up because there's so much trash out there. So illegal dumping is an issue for us. A lot of our eastern Oregon rangelands become open, I guess you could say, and people will dump all manner of things there. We found some very interesting stuff on the lands. We kind of wonder what society's about sometimes when you look at what's being dumped. But it is a problem. And maybe, we try to work with law enforcement.
Maybe
when
we come back for work section to work this bill, you can give us some comments on the criminal mischief and on the, if that's appropriate or whatever.
Mr. Chair, yeah, just to follow up, I think we ought to, if this is an issue that's happening out in remote areas, that we ought to maybe make sure those things are at the same level, because if we can catch somebody, a lot of time it might be the same type of person, and if we're going to invest in that equipment and those kinds of things, maybe there could be some similar crime
levels. We'll see if we can
levels.
Back to the work session. Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can recall back in the 70s, 80s, of getting the owner-editor of the paper publisher there in Brookings and actually taking him up the Chetco River, and we put up a sign and we sat back and waited maybe 15 minutes, first or second rig through on a Saturday, and bang, 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 play off the sign, and I'm watching this, and I cite him, and he writes this big article in the paper. And the judge got down on these people about as hard as they could. Well, you'd be surprised what an effect that had on that type of activity. I thought that was just to show you some enforcement does have an effect. But it's so rural that not often can you be there, you know, unless you actually set yourself up almost like an entrapment, I guess you'd say. There's also a difference between private land and public land. In recent years, where liability on public land, large timber companies or ranches, the type of gate that they are putting in, and they're putting a large investment into that gate, I mean very large, maybe $10,000-$15,000 in some instances between the gate and getting the land in the rock, and so they can't, you know, go around the banks. They're doing that, and once those types of very quality gate structures are put in, they're not as much subject to being messed with, and people kind of get used to that, realizing that most of the timber companies are going to open that up to access for hunting, and maybe you can even get a key if you have some other reason to go in there. But there is some expectation on public lands that they should be open, and people resent the public lands when they're locked up. So I think maybe the public lands need to be better gated, and if you're going to put up a sign with a wooden post, it's a waste of time. You need to go to a steel post, concrete filled, and put it up where they can't get at it so easy, not at the gate, up on the bank, off to the side 15, 20, 30 feet, concrete it in, tie it back. So they really got to go to a huge effort to pull it over, knock it over. They're not going to shoot it down. You're not going to use wood. You're going to use heavy metal. And those are the type of things we're going to have to do. And once they get into the mindset that, hey, these are permanent type things, they're going to be there, they're not easy to destroy, they're not going to be wasting their ammunition. And there's also, I think, a culture amongst hunters and gun owners now to try to teach their children and their, you know, their friends that go out there that this conduct is not acceptable. And you see the Oregon Hunters and NRA and all of those type of groups stressing that this is what brings a bad look or a bad vision of what they are. And so I think that will help in the future. But perhaps we need to work better with those groups of people to inform the people who own firearms to be responsible how they do it. Also, when we're out there, is, and the good representative here worked Fish and Wildlife for, 4 years? When we stop people out there, I'll bet you 90% of the time there's a gun in that vehicle, whether they're out there hunting or if they're out fishing or whatever they're doing out there. And with that, years ago, it was customary to have the six-pack of beer on the seat. You're seeing that decline, where there's not as many people with alcohol and guns, which is good. They don't mix real well. But culture's changing. Education's part of this. I think, I don't know, I'd like to talk to the Department of Fish and Wildlife on the hunter education program for kids, how that's being stressed, because they all have to have that. And that might be an opportunity to inform people better than what we are now.
Thank you, Representative Krieger. Any other comments or questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it just anecdotally, it just seems that, and I live in Aloha, Beaverton area, but I just see more litter around there than I used to see as well. It just, there's something of the people who are, I don't know, maybe transplanted into the area that didn't come up with the Oregon ethic and not doing that. But what I wanted to ask you, would it be helpful if we were to change along some of these ATV trails that they'd be closed unless posted open? Because I know in other cases, in when I was a game warden, I'd see someone and they'd say, you know, no motorcycles, and that'd be gone 10 minutes later. So I was thinking, you know, at that time, we ought to have a law that you can't go on the trail unless it says open to motorcycles. Then they won't be tearing those signs down, or hopefully it wouldn't. But, I mean, would that be helpful if we could maybe shift some responsibility that way, that you that it wrote, that an area would be designated closed unless it was posted open?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, that would probably help. My guess is would probably receive a lot of opposition from the public.
Yeah.
Representative Krueger hit it right on the head. You know, the public wants their public lands open.
Right.
When we closed ATV use, which we did up on the Columbia River because of conflicts with ATV users and the adjacent landowners, ATV users coming up on private land and tearing up the private land, we tried to put up the state land boundary sign. So at least we could tell them, if you stay on this side, you're on public land, and it's okay to be here. But if you get on this side, you're not okay. And those signs, unfortunately, didn't last very long. But, you know, I think that it would certainly help. But I think you'd probably get some pretty serious public opposition.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Purchase.
Thank you.
We have a representative from the Oregon Forest Industries, Mike.
I work with him quite a bit.
Morning, Chair. Where's the members of the committee? For the record, Mike Deichsel, Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council here in Salem. Just applaud the group on the dialogue that's happened here. He's pretty much taken most of my testimony already and run with it, so I think that's a good thing. When this bill came up and Representative Lim's office contacted OFIC to see if we would be interested in working on the bill, I jumped at the chance. This is anything that we can do to raise the level of awareness to what goes on out in the forested lands. And as Representative Krueger points out, the distinction that's nice about this bill, it doesn't make any difference between federal lands, private lands. The vandalism and trespass issues that we see out there is non-discriminate. It happens just about anywhere. And so what I put out an all-call to, not an all-call, but a select group of our members to see, can you give me some anecdotal evidence that I can bring to testify today? The email just about exploded. This is a very high subject of interest for our landowners, protecting their lands from liability issues, protecting their lands from water quality issues, trespass, vandalism, fire danger. There's a whole host of reasons to manage that liability, and the one method that seems to be most common is they manage it with controlled access. And so I kind of point out a few things here, and with all the responses I got, I thought two of them kind of highlighted. So the first one, I'll just read a couple of the short inserts there from the bottom, which is comes from a sheriff's co-op deputy. As part of the discussion has happened today, downsizing, limited resources for any enforcement agency in the woods anymore is you just don't see them anymore. Budgets have pretty much curtailed all that. Some counties have worked with landowners to develop what they call a co-op deputy program, where a number of landowners within a county band together and they all contribute resources, as Representative Cameron probably experienced. The Polk County is one that has worked. There's a number of other counties that are right now trying to assess the rural school funds, what the impacts of that going to be. Lane County, for example, currently has six forest deputies in the sheriff's department that will be reduced to zero should the rural schools fund go away, and they're already trying to develop an interest for the landowners down there to try and fund one deputy. So I think a couple of the paragraphs here really summarize it. I'll start with the third one from the bottom. There is, in 2006 alone, parking pay vaults were broken into twice, once cut completely apart with a torch. As an information kiosk was cut down to use used to fuel a party fire. Numerous road signs were stolen. At least eight locks were cut off of the same gate. In numerous occasions since January of this year, two stop signs were pushed over and stolen, and six locks have been cut off the same gate. So as we deal with some of the comments that Representative Krueger mentioned, even putting in concrete signs, steel posts, it just doesn't matter. In my old working career in South Central Oregon, we used to do some pretty heavy-duty gate work that was actually used railroad track iron to build gates with. And you'd go out and have a piece of well casing that incorporated the lock and a pin. And I'd go out there some days and actually see an armor-piercing round go through the outer side of the well casing through the lock and exiting on the backside. So I don't care what you put out there, you're going to spend a whole lot of money to try and keep the honest people honest, and I'm here to say that roughly 97% of the public is honest. You put out a few signs, you educate them as to what's perceived, what's good here, what's bad here, what we allow here, what we don't. The 3%, they're going to come out with cutting torches, and I don't care how big of a tank trap that's the challenge to those folks. And obviously the cost, as Representative Krueger mentioned, has gone considerably higher. Each time we try and up the ante, they can counter it, and we just kind of get in this escalation of trying to keep them out, but the risk and the liability continues to escalate right along with it. So I think that if all my testimony, the one comment from a sheriff, the very last paragraph on that front page is, the majority of the incidents are easily over $100 in value. It would be nice to have some enhanced fines and penalties, but the DA has to charge them as crimes and not dismiss them or reduce them to violations. I know every county is a little different, but here in our county, 95% of my arrests are reduced to violations, and I then have to prosecute them myself. I think the bigger issue here is the adequate funding and the dedication of each county to actually prosecute the crimes. If somebody gets off scot-free with just a violation, that's not a big deal. I think on the back, just one member, just to kind of summarize, three gates on one particular day cost a little over $3,000 worth of damage. Just happens all the time. Number of gates, you try and think about, you know, a little master lock, you know, well, those nice big bolt cutters that people bring to the woods don't know any difference between a master lock or a best lock at $75 a piece. You may not be able to code the keys and all that, but they take a bolt cutter exactly the same. Another member just came in this morning. He had 185 different incidences to vandalism and trespass to gates and signs in the last year at a cost of a little over $18,000. While your focus here is including it in the Class 2 misdemeanor, I think that's a good thing. Anything we can do to raise the level of awareness, anything we can do to minimize the unfortunate circumstances that happened with the Kim family, I think that's our ultimate focus here. But reality, there's a lot of things that happen with people that don't know the woods. They're not wood-wise. But it's the public out there that's cutting off gates and locks that leave it open, and it looks like tracks have gone down there, so the unsuspecting public follows right along, and that's where they get into trouble. The broader considerations in my bullet points on the back there, I know it's maybe just a little bit outside of the specific focus of the bill, but I'd sure like the folks to consider in the committee throughout their deliberations this session, is that the full impact of the crime includes the labor and time and materials to return the equipment to pre-damaged condition, if that's even possible. The time is lost to other business needs while you're conducting these repairs that will never be recovered. The cost recovery for these restitution efforts can only be realized through restitution, assuming the guilty party is apprehended and prosecuted. The county resources continue to be stretched thin, prioritizing efforts and expenditures upon urban and violent crimes, which we totally understand and support that there is a priority that has to happen. Our members do feel, though, that there's a significant land base that's being taxed out there from our landowners within the county, that a certain basic level of service and prosecution should be afforded to those private forest land owners. There's not a uniform understanding of the types of crimes or the value of the repairs to these forest resources, the minor forest products theft, logging equipment, and vandalism. And as the sheriff commented, the reduction from arrests only to violations in his particular county sends a message that these crimes don't warrant the resources to prosecute them. The stance does nothing to deter the problem or set an example that these crimes will not be tolerated. And just in summary, we realize that these additional issues are beyond the scope of House Bill 2511, but are definitely related. We hope that the comments from those who are charged with protecting the forest resources and the safety of the visitors and workers in the forest will be of benefit to the committee in their current and future deliberations. And I think several comments that have happened today just kind of underscore where OFIC is on this. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Krieger.
Earlier, Mike, Representative Cameron was talking about cameras, and they have these new big game motion activated cameras that you can put out on a trail if you want to know if elk are going by. You can leave them there a week or two, and they take instant shots. Do you know if anyone's tried to utilize that at a high incident area to actually get the license number or picture of somebody doing this?
Chair, wasn't it Representative Krieger? Technology continues to increase leaps and bounds. A lot of military research has been done. Representative Cameron went out with the group. I've been on with that tour with that group as well. They have lost a few cameras as well, too. If they don't happen to hide them efficiently or effectively, or put it relatively in a position where they can record a license plate coming down the road that happens to have enough cover where you can hide the battery and the trip switches and all that. In some unfortunate cases, they put them so close to signs that they became a target and actually were shot through the lens and destroyed. But they are running somewhere in the range of anywhere from $2,000 to $5,000 per unit. It's very costly, very expensive, but there has been a number of successes, especially in the Dump Stoppers program, which in Polk County was kind of the second of the two counties. Clackamas County initiated that and had huge success with the amount of resources that have been cleaned up, opportunities for work crews to go out and help clean up. But once again, having the people out there to actually see it, or tipsters that see a truck going down the road to the forest with a whole covered tarp load of trash and come back empty for them to call in. But we've also heard from some counties that a forest landowner that has an issue out in the woods, and they call up and ask for someone to come out, and they ask for a street address where the officer could respond to, and they say, well, it's out in the forest, and there is no address. Well, we don't have the resources or equipment that we can even respond to. So it is a mixed bag.
Thank you. Any other questions, this witness? Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you.
I'd hope that Steve and Mike both, that you're going to provide some input to the governor's task force on the Kim incident. I'm sure your departments or your association have representatives on that task force, and Representative Barker and Krieger, too, should look at providing some testimony or input to them. I think we've had good discussions on this. So.
One other item, if I may, came up this morning while your dialogue. There's a Federal Forest Land Advisory Committee that ODF is working on currently to understand the role of the state forestry and its reactions and interactions with the federal government about harvest levels, wildlife management, all the other benefits that actually they're currently in a comment period that I'd be more than glad to submit some testimony on behalf of this issue to that group.
Thank you, Mike.
Steve, while you're there, I forgot I was going to ask this question.
Mike or Steve?
Either one. I'm sorry. Do you have any idea of the age range of the people that do this level of vandalism?
Chair Wesnitt and Representative Comp, I think it runs the whole gambit.
Okay.
I'm encouraged that some of the other things and discussions that have taken place, that some of the educational aspects that the children in some of the schools are getting is that anytime you throw a gum wrapper down, it's like, well, Mom, Dad, you can't do that. You need to take care of the environment. I think those are good, but there's still a faction out there that, because there's no prosecution and no accountability, that they continue to get away with it. One of the comments you see in ours, the landowner on the top of the back page there, attributed to a number of incidences happened during hunting season, generally that even though their lands are open to the public, they still have damage. It's one thing to have your lands closed and experience a lot of gates and signs shot up when you're restricting access, but even if they're very active in operating with them, they still receive the damage. I'm very conscious we have a great working relationship with the Oregon Hunters Association. We do a lot of cooperative work together, and that group does an awful lot of policing on their own, and I don't see that it would be a reputable member of that group. I think it's just kind of a rogue situation. Anytime you get more people in the woods, you're going to get more damage.
Just a follow-up comment, and I really do appreciate the comments that were made by Representative Krieger and Barker also on this. And my background is in education, and I just know that when you have probation officers working with juveniles about restitution, the point gets home real quick. And so that anything that we can do to encourage that level of education, when people are younger, to say, this is going to cost you big money. And we dealt with it repeatedly with gang graffiti. Young people get the message real quick, and you're right, they do steal the cameras, they do all those things, but with some vigilance, you can counteract some of that.
Good. Thank you. Well, committee, I think we have some good dialogue. We'll have to tell Chair McPherson that there was support for this bill, and we also got some information we should take to the task force. So hearing no other questions, I'll close the public hearing on 2511. Any comments for the good of the order? Thank you for your support.
You did pretty well.
We'll close the committee.